Star Wars, The Last Command, by Timothy Zahn, continued. Cassette number 7, side 2. Have you ever met my associate, Gent? For a moment, Gillespie just stared at him, looking puzzled. Then, abruptly, he got it. You wouldn't. Why not? Carter countered. On the contrary, we'd be doing them a service. Why clutter their lives with these troublesome accounting details while they're trying to survive a war? And since they'd have to pay anyway once we found the clone center for them? Exactly, Carter nodded. We can consider this merely a prepayment for work about to be rendered. Just as well they won't know about it until it's over, Gillespie said dryly. Question is, can Gent pull it off? Easily, Carter assured him, particularly since he's inside the Imperial Palace on Coruscant at the moment. I was planning to head that way soon to pick up Mara anyway. I'll simply have him slice into some sector fleet records and write us in. Gillespie exhaled noisily. It's got possibilities. I'll give it that much. Don't know if it'll be enough to get the others back on board, though. Then we'll just have to ask them, Carter said, stepping back to his desk. Invitations for, say, 4 days from now? Gillespie shrugged. Give it a try. What have you got to lose? Carter sobered. With Grand Admiral Thrawn, he reminded the other, that's not a question to ever ask lightly. The evening breezes moved through the crumbling walls and stone columns of the ruined fortress, occasionally whistling softly as it found its way through a small hole or crevice. Sitting with his back to one of the pillars, Carter sipped at his cup and watched the last sliver of the sun disappear below the horizon. On the plain below, the long shadows stretching across the scarred ground were beginning to fade as the coming darkness of night began its inexorable move across the landscape. All in all, rather symbolic of the way this galactic war had finally caught up with Carter himself. He took another sip from his cup, marveling once again at this whole absurd situation. Here he was, an intelligent, calculating, appropriately selfish smuggler, who'd made a successful career out of keeping his distance from galactic politics. A smuggler, moreover, who'd sworn explicitly to keep his people out of this particular war. And yet, somehow, here he was, squarely in the middle of it. And not only in the middle of it, but trying his best to drag other smugglers in after him. He shook his head in vague annoyance. This exact same thing, he knew, had happened to Han Solo sometime around the Big Yavin battle. He could remember being highly amused by Solo's gradual entanglement in the Rebel Alliance's nets of duty and responsibility. Looking at it from the inside of the net, the whole thing wasn't nearly so entertaining. From across the battered courtyard came the faint sound of crunching gravel. Carter turned to look at the line of stone pillars in that direction, his hand dropping to his blaster. No one else was supposed to be here at the moment. Sturm, he called softly. Drang. The familiar cackling purr came in response, and Carter let out a quiet sigh of relief. Over here, he called to the animal. Come on, over here. The order was unnecessary. The Vornskr was already loping around the pillars toward him, its muzzle low to the ground, the stub of its truncated whip tail wagging madly behind him. Probably Drang, Carter decided. He was the more sociable of the two, and Sturm had a tendency to dawdle over his meals. The Vornskr skidded to a halt beside him, giving another of his strange cackle purrs, a rather mournful one this time, as he pressed his muzzle up into Carter's outstretched palm. It was Drang, all right. Yes, it's very quiet, Carter told him, running his hand back up across the animal's face and around to scratch at the sensitive skin behind his ears. But the others will be back soon. They've just gone out to check on the other ships. Trung gave another mournful cackle purr and dropped into a half-crouch beside Carter's chair, staring alertly out over the empty plain below. But whatever he was looking for, he didn't find it. And after a moment, he growled deep in his throat and lowered his muzzle to rest on the stone. His ears twitched once, as if straining to hear a sound that wasn't there. And then they, too, folded back down. It's quiet down there, too, Carter agreed soberly, stroking the Vornsker's fur. What do you suppose happened here? Drung didn't answer. Carter gazed down at the Vornsker's lean, muscled back, wondering yet again about these strange predators he'd so casually, perhaps even arrogantly, decided to make pets of. Wondering if he'd have thought twice about doing so, if he'd realized that he was dealing with possibly the only animals in the galaxy who hunted via the Force. It was a preposterous conclusion on the face of it. Force sensitivity itself wasn't unheard of, certainly. The Gotal had a fairly useless form of it. And there were persistent rumors about the Dwinoagwim as well, to name just two. But all those who had such sensitivity were sentient creatures, with the high levels of intelligence and self-awareness that that implied. For non-sentient animals to use the Force this way was something new. But it was a conclusion that the events of the past few months had forced him to. There had been his pet's unexpected reaction to Luke Skywalker at Carda's Mirka base. There'd been the similar, and again, previously unseen reaction to Mara aboard the Wild Carda, just before the hunch she'd had that had saved them from that Imperial Interdictor cruiser. There'd been the far more vicious reaction of the Wild Vornskers toward both Mara and Skywalker during their three-day trek through the Mirker forests. Skywalker was a Jedi. Mara had shown some decidedly Jedi-like talents. And perhaps even more telling, the existence of the bizarre Force-empty bubbles created by Mirker's Isalamiri could finally be explained if they were simply a form of defense or camouflage against predators. Abruptly, Drung's head snapped up, his ears stiffening as he twisted halfway round. Carda strained his ears, and a few seconds later he heard the faint sounds of the returning shuttle. "It's all right," he assured the Vornsker. "It's just Chin and the others back from the ship." Drung held the pose a moment longer. Then, as if deciding to take Carda's word for it, he turned and laid his head back down again. Looking out over a plain that, if Carda's suspicion was right, was more silent even for him than it was for Carda. "Don't worry," he soothed the animal, scratching again behind his ears. "We'll be out of here soon, and I promise that the next place we go will have plenty of other life around for you to listen to." The Vornsker's ears twitched, but that might have been just the scratching. Taking one last look at the fading colors of sunset, Carter stood up, resettling his gun belt across his hips. There was no particular reason to go in yet, of course. The invitations had been written, encrypted, and transmitted, and for now there was nothing to do except wait for the replies. But suddenly it felt lonely out here, much lonelier than it had a few minutes ago. "Come on, Drung," he said, reaching down for one last pat. "Time to go in." The shuttle settled to the floor of the Chimera's hangar bay, release valves hissing over the heads of the stormtroopers, moving purposefully into escort position around the lowering ramp. Pelion stayed where he was beside Thrawn, grimacing at the smell of the skid gases, and wishing he knew what in the Empire the Grand Admiral was up to this time. Whatever it was, he had a bad feeling that he wasn't going to like it. Thrawn could talk all he liked about how predictable these smugglers were, and maybe, to him, they were. But Pelion had had his own share of dealings with this sort of fringe scum, and he'd never yet seen a deal that hadn't gone sour one way or the other. And none of those deals had started from the sheer audacity of an attack on an Imperial shipyard. The ramp finished its descent and locked in place. The stormtrooper commander peered up into the shuttle and nodded. And, flanked by two black-clad fleet troopers, the prisoner descended to the deck.
"Ah, Captain Mazik,"
Thrawn said smoothly, as the stormtroopers fell into escort positions around him.
"Welcome to the Chimera. I apologize for this rather theatrical summons and any problems it may have created in your business scheduling. But there are certain matters that cannot be discussed other than face-to-face."
"You're very funny," Mazik snarled. A marked contrast, Pelion thought, to the suave, sophisticated ladies man that had been profiled in Intelligence's files. But then the knowledge that one was facing an Imperial interrogation was enough to strip the civilized polish from any man.
"How did you find me?"
"Come now, Captain," Thrawn admonished him calmly. "Did you seriously think you could hide from me if I wanted you found?"
"Carda managed it,"
Mazik shot back, trying hard to put up a good front. But the manacled hands were working nervously at each other.
"You still haven't got him, have you?"
"Carda's time will come," Thrawn told him, his voice still calm but noticeably cooler. "But we're not talking about Carda. We're talking about you."
"Yes, and I'm sure you're looking forward to it," Mazik growled, waving his manacled hands. "Let's get it over with."
Thrawn's eyebrows lifted slightly.
"You misunderstand, Captain. You're not here for punishment. You're here because I wanted to clear the air between us."
Mazik paused in mid-bluster.
"What are you talking about?"
he asked suspiciously.
"I'm talking about the recent incident at the Bilbringi shipyards," Thrawn said. "No, don't deny it. I know it was you and Elor who destroyed that unfinished Star Destroyer. And normally, the Empire would exact an extremely high price for such an act. However, under these particular circumstances, I'm prepared to let it go."
Mazik stared at him.
"I don't understand."
"It's very simple, Captain."
Thrawn gestured, and one of Mazik's escort began removing his restraints.
"Your attack on Bilbringi was in revenge for a similar attack against a smugglers' meeting you attended on Trogon. All well and good, except that neither I nor any senior Imperial officer authorized that attack. In fact, the garrison commander had explicit orders to leave your meeting alone."
Mazik snorted.
"You expect me to believe that?"
Thrawn's eyes glittered.
"Would you rather believe I was so incompetent that I allowed an inadequate field force to be sent on a mission?"
he bit out. Mazik eyed him, still hostile, but starting to look a little thoughtful as well.
"I always thought we got away too easily," he muttered.
"Then we understand each other," Thrawn said, his voice calm again. "And the matter is settled. The shuttle has orders to take you back to your base."
He smiled faintly.
"Or rather, to the backup base your ship and crew will have fled to by now on Lelmra. Again, my apologies for the inconvenience."
Mazik's eyes darted around the hangar bay, his expression halfway between suspicion that this was a trick and an almost painfully eager hope that it wasn't.
"And I'm just supposed to believe you?" he demanded. You're welcome to believe anything you wish, Thrawn said. But remember that I had you in my hand and that I let you go. Good day, Captain.
He started to turn away.
So who were they? Mazik called after him. If they weren't Imperial troops, I mean.
Thrawn turned back to face him.
They were indeed Imperial troops, he said. Our inquiries are still incomplete, but at the moment it appears that Lieutenant Kosk and his men were attempting to make a little extra money on the side.
Mazik stared.
Someone hired them to hit us? Imperial troops?
Even Imperial troops are not always immune to the lure of bribery, Thrawn said, his voice dark with an excellent imitation of bitter contempt. In this case, they paid for their treason with their lives. Be assured that the person or persons responsible will pay a similar price.
You know who it was? Mazik demanded.
I believe I know, Thrawn said. As yet, I have no proof.
Give me a hint.
Thrawn smiled sardonically.
Form your own hints, Captain. Good day.
He turned and strode back toward the archway leading to the service and prep areas. Pelion waited long enough to watch Mazik and his escort turn and start back up into the shuttle, then hurried to join him.
Do you think you gave him enough, Admiral? He asked quietly.
It won't matter, Captain, Thrawn assured him. We've given him all that's necessary, and if Mazik himself isn't clever enough to finger Carta, one of the other smuggler chiefs will be. In any case, it's always better to offer too little rather than too much. Some people automatically distrust free information.
Behind them, the shuttle lifted from the deck and swung back around into space. And from the archway ahead, a grinning figure emerged.
Nicely done, Admiral, Niall Ferrier said, shifting his cigar to the other side of his mouth. You got him all squirmy and then tossed him back. He'll be thinking about that for a long time.
Thank you, Ferrier, Thrawn said dryly. Your approval means so very much to me.
For a second, the ship thief's grin seemed to slip. Then, apparently, he decided to take the comment at face value.
Okay, he said. So what's our next move?
Thrawn's eyes flashed at the hour, but he let it go.
Carta sent out a series of transmissions last night, one of which we intercepted, he said. We're still decrypting it, but it can only be a call for another meeting. Once we have the location and time, they'll be provided to you.
And I'll go and help Mazik finger Carta, Ferrier nodded.
You'll do nothing of the sort, Thrawn said sharply. You will sit in a corner and keep your mouth shut.
Ferrier seemed to shrink back.
Okay, sure.
Thrawn held his gaze another moment.
What you will do, he continued at last, is to make certain that a certain data card is placed into Carta's possession, preferably in the office aboard his ship. That will be where Mazik will probably look first.
He motioned, and an officer stepped forward and handed Ferrier a data card.
Ah, Ferrier said slyly as he took it. Yeah, I get it. The record of Carta's deal with this Lieutenant Kosk, huh?
Correct, Thrawn said. That, plus the supporting evidence we've already inserted into Kosk's own personal records, should leave no doubt that Carta has been manipulating the other smugglers. I expect that to be more than adequate.
Yeah, they're a pretty nasty bunch, all right.
Ferrier turned the data card over in his hand, chewing on his cigar.
Okay. So all I gotta do is get aboard the wild card.
He broke off at the look on Thrawn's face.
No, the Grand Admiral said quietly. On the contrary, you'll stay as far away from his ship and private ground facilities as possible. In fact, you will never allow yourself to be alone while you're at his base.
Ferrier blinked in surprise.
Yeah, but...
Helplessly, he held up the data card. Beside him, Pelion felt Thrawn's sigh of strained patience.
Your Defil will be the one to plant the data card aboard the Wild Carda.
Ferrier's face cleared.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he can probably slip in and out without anyone even noticing.
He had better, Thrawn warned.
And suddenly his voice was icy cold.
Because I haven't forgotten your role in the deaths of Lieutenant Kosk and his men. You owe the Empire, Ferrier, and that debt will be paid.
Behind his beard, Ferrier's face had gone a little pale.
I got it, Admiral.
Good, Thrawn said. You'll remain on your ship until Decrypt obtains the location of Carda's meeting for you. After that, you'll be on your own.
Sure, Ferrier said, stuffing the data card into his tunic. So, after they take care of Carda, what do I do?
You'll be free to go about your business, Thrawn said. When I want you again, I'll let you know.
Ferrier's lip twitched. Sure, he repeated. And on his face, Pelion saw that he was slowly starting to realize just how deep his debt to the Empire really was. Chapter 16. The planet was green and blue and mottled white, pretty much like all the other planets Han had dropped in on over the years, with the minor exception that this one didn't have a name, or spaceports, or orbit facilities, or cities, power plants, or other ships, or much of anything else.
That's it, huh? He asked Mara.
She didn't answer. Han looked over and found her staring at the planet hanging out there in front of them.
Well, is it or isn't it? He prompted.
It is, she said, her voice strangely hollow. We're here.
Good, Han said, still frowning at her. Great. You're going to tell us where this mountain is, or are we just going to fly around and see where we draw fire from?
Mara seemed to shake herself.
It's about halfway between the equator and the North Pole, she said, near the eastern edge of the main continent. A single mountain rising out of forest and grassland.
Okay, Han said, feeding in the information and hoping the sensors wouldn't loop out and fail on him.
Mara had made enough snide comments about the Falcon as it was. Behind him, the cockpit door slid open, and Lando and Chewbacca came in.
How about it? Lando asked. We there?
We're there,
Mara said, before Han could answer. Chewbacca rumbled a question.
No, seems to be a real low-tech place, Han shook his head. No power sources or transmissions anywhere.
Military bases? Lando asked.
If they're there, I can't find them, Han said.
Interesting, Lando murmured, peering over Mara's shoulder. I wouldn't have pegged the Grand Admiral as being the trusting sort.
The place was designed to be a private storehouse, Mara reminded him tartly, not a display ad for Imperial hardware. There weren't any garrisons or command centers scattered around for Thrawn to have moved into.
So whatever he's got will be stashed inside the mountain? Han asked.
Plus probably a few ground patrols just outside, Mara said, but they won't have any fighter squadrons or heavy weaponry to throw at us.
That'll be a nice change, Lando said wryly.
Unless Thrawn decided to put up a couple of garrisons on his own, Han pointed out. You and Chewie'd better charge up the quads just in case.
Right.
The two of them left. Han shifted into a general approach vector, then keyed for a sensor search. Trouble? Mara asked. Probably not, Han assured her, watching the displays. But there was nothing showing anywhere around them. A couple of times on the way in, I thought I spotted something hanging around back there. Calrissian thought he saw something when we changed course at Obroa Sky, too, Mara said, peering down at the display. Could be something with a really good sensor stealth mode.
Or just a glitch, Han said.
The Febratech's been giving us trouble lately.
Mara craned her neck to look out to starboard.
Could someone have followed us here from Coruscant?
Who knew we were coming? Han countered. No, there was nothing there. Must have been his imagination.
How much of this private storehouse did you see? Slowly, Mara turned back to face forward, not looking all that convinced.
Not much more than the route between the entrance and the throne room at the top, she said. But I know where the Sperti cylinder chamber is.
How about the power generators?
I never actually saw them, she said. But I remember hearing that the cooling system pulls in water from a river flowing down the northeastern slope of the mountain. They're probably somewhere on that side.
Han chewed at his lip. And the main entrance is on the southwest side.
The only entrance, she corrected. There's just the one way in or out.
I've heard that before.
This time it's true, she retorted.
Han shrugged.
Okay, he said. There was no point in arguing about it, not until they'd looked the place over anyway.
The cockpit door slid open, and he glanced over his shoulder to see Luke come in.
We're here, kid, he said.
I know, Luke said, moving forward to stand behind Mara. Mara told me. Han threw a look at Mara. Near as he could tell, she'd spent the whole trip avoiding Luke, which wasn't all that easy on a ship the size of the Falcon. Luke had returned the favor by staying out of her way, which wasn't much easier.
She did, huh?
It's all right, Luke assured him, gazing out at the planet ahead.
So that's Wayland.
That's Wayland,
Mara said shortly, unstrapping and brushing past Luke.
I'll be in back,
she said over her shoulder, and left.
You two work so well together, Han commented, as the cockpit door slid shut behind her.
Actually, we do, Luke said, sliding into the co-pilot's seat Mara had just vacated. You should have seen us aboard the Chimera when we went in to rescue Carda. She's a good person to have at your side.
Han threw him a sideways look.
Except when she wants to slide a knife in it.
I'm willing to take my chances, Luke smiled.
Must be one of those crazy Jedi things.
This isn't funny, Luke, Han growled. She hasn't given up on killing you, you know. She told Leia that back on Coruscant.
Which tells me that she really doesn't want to do it, Luke countered. People don't usually go around announcing murder plans in advance, especially not to the victim's family.
You willing to bet your life on that?
Luke shrugged fractionally.
I already have.
The Falcon was skimming along the outer atmosphere now, and the computer had finally identified a probable location for Mount Tantus.
Well, if you ask me, this isn't a good time to be running short odds, he told Luke, giving the sensor map a quick study.
A straight-in southern approach, he decided. That would give them forest cover for both the landing and the overland trip.
You have any suggestions? Luke asked.
Yeah, I've got one, Anne said, changing course toward the distant mountain. We leave her with the Falcon at the landing site.
Alive?
At other times in his life, Anne reflected, it wouldn't necessarily have been a ridiculous question.
Of course alive, he said stiffly. There are a lot of ways to keep her from getting into trouble.
You really think she'd agree to stay behind?
No one said we had to ask her.
Luke shook his head. We can't do that, Hen. She needs to see this through.
Which part of it? Hen growled. Hitting the clone factory or trying to kill you?
I don't know, Luke said quietly. Maybe both.
Hen had never liked forests very much before joining the Rebel Alliance, which wasn't to say he disliked them either. Forests were simply not something the average smuggler thought about very much. Most of the time, you picked up and delivered in grimy little spaceports like Mos Eisley or Abrigado Rey. And on the rare occasion where you met in a forest, you let the customer watch the forest while you watch the customer. As a result, Han had wound up with the vague sort of assumption that one forest was pretty much like another. His stint with the Alliance had changed all that. What with Endor, Corstris, Fedya, and a dozen more, he'd learned the hard way that each forest was different, with its own array of plants, animal life, and general all-around headaches for the casual visitor. Just one of many subjects the Alliance had taught him more about than he'd really wanted to know. Wayland's forest fit the pattern perfectly, and the first headache proved to be how to get the Falcon down through the dense upper leaf canopy without leaving a hole any wandering Imperial TIE pilot would have to be asleep to miss. They'd first had to find a gap, in this case made by a fallen tree. And then he'd had to basically run the ship in on its side. A lot trickier maneuver in a planetary gravity well than it was out in an asteroid field. The secondary canopy, which he didn't find out about until he was most of the way through the first, was the second headache. And he tore the tops off a line of those shorter trees before he got the Falcon stabilized and down, crunching a lot of underbrush in the process.
Nice landing, Lando commented dryly, rubbing his shoulder beneath the restraint strap as Han shut down the repulsor lifts.
At least the sensor dish is still there, Han said pointedly.
Lando winced.
You're never going to let that go, are you?
Han shrugged, keying in the lifeform algorithms. Time to find out what was out there.
You said you wouldn't get a scratch on her, he reminded the other.
Fine, Lando grumped. Next time, I'll destroy the energy field generator, and you can fly her down the Death Star's throat.
Which wasn't all that funny. If the Empire got enough of its old resources back again, Thrawn just might try to build another of the blasted things.
We're ready back here, Luke said, poking his head into the cockpit. How's it look?
Not too bad, Han said, reading off the display. Got a bunch of animals out there, but they're keeping their distance.
How big are these animals? Lando asked, leaning over Han's shoulder to have a look at the display.
And how many to a bunch? Luke added.
About 15, Han told him. Nothing we can't handle if we need to. Let's go take a look.
Mara and Chewbacca were waiting at the hatchway with R2 and 3PO, the latter keeping his mouth shut for a change.
Chewie and me'll go first, Han told him, drawing his blaster. The rest of you stay sharp up here.
He punched the controls, and the hatchway slid open as the entry ramp lowered, settling into the dead leaves with a muffled crunch.
Trying to watch all directions at once, Han started down. He spotted the first of the animals before he'd reached the bottom of the ramp. Gray, with a freckling of white across its back, maybe 2 meters from nose to tail tuft. It was crouched at the base of a tree limb, its beady little eyes following him as he walked. And if its teeth and claws were anything to go by, it was definitely a predator. Beside him, Chewbacca rumbled softly. "Yeah, I see it," Han muttered back. "There are another 14 out there somewhere, too." The Wookiee growled again, gesturing. "You're right," Han agreed slowly, eyeing the predator. "It does kind of look familiar. Like those Pantech things from Bantessa, maybe." Chewbacca considered, then growled a negative. "Well, we'll figure it out later," Han decided. "Luke?" "Right here," Luke's voice came down from the hatchway. "You and Mara start bringing the equipment down," Han ordered, watching the predator closely. The sound of conversation didn't seem to be bothering it any. "Start with the speeder bikes. Lando, you're high cover. Stay sharp." "Right," Lando said. From above came a handful of pops and clicks as the transport restraints around the first 2 speeder bikes were knocked off, then the faint hum as the repulsor lifts were activated. And with a sudden violent crackling of leaves and branches, the predator leaped. "Chewie!" was all Han had time to shout before the animal was on top of him. He fired, the blaster bolt catching it square in the torso, and managed to duck as the carcass shot past his head. Chewbacca was roaring Wookiee battle cries, swinging his bowcaster around and firing again and again as more of the predators charged at them from out of the trees. From the hatchway, someone shouted something, and another shot flashed out. And, out of the corner of his eye, moving much too fast to avoid, Han saw a set of claws coming in his direction. He threw up his forearm across his face, ducking his head back as far out of the way as he could. An instant later, he was knocked back off his feet as the predator slammed full tilt into him. A moment of pressure and lancing pain as the claws dug through his camouflage jacket. And then, suddenly, the weight was gone. He lowered his arm, just in time to see the predator bound onto the ramp and prepare for a spring into the Falcon. He twisted around and fired, just as a shot from inside the ship also caught it. Chewbacca snarled a warning. Still on his back, Han swung around to see 3 more of the animals bounding across the ground toward him. He dropped one with a pair of quick shots and was trying to swing his blaster around to target the second when a pair of black-booted feet hit the ground just in front of him. The animals leaped upward into a blurred line of brilliant green and crashed to the ground. Rolling over, Han scrambled back to his feet and looked around. Luke was standing in a half-crouch in front of him, lightsaber humming in ready position. On the other side of the ramp, Chewbacca was still on his feet, with 3 of the speckled animals lying dead around him. Han looked down at the dead predator beside him. Now that he had a good, close look at the thing... "Watch out, there are 3 more over there," Luke warned. Han looked. 2 of the animals were visible, crouched low down in the trees. "They won't bother us. Any of them get into the ship?" "Not very far into it," Luke told him. "What did you do that set them off?" "We didn't do anything," Han said, holstering his blaster. "It was you and Mara turning on the speeder bikes." Chewbacca rumbled with sudden recognition. "You got it, pal," Han nodded. "That's where we tangled with them, all right." "What are they?" Luke asked.
"They're called Garrels," Mara said from the ramp.
Crouching down, her own blaster still drawn, she was peering at the carcasses scattered around Chewbacca.
"The Empire used to use them as watchdogs.
usually near heavily wooded frontier garrisons where probe droid pickets weren't practical. There's something in the ultrasonic signature of a repulsor lift that's supposed to sound like one of their prey animals, draws them like a magnet.
So that's why they were sitting here waiting for us, Luke said, closing down his lightsaber but keeping it handy.
They can hear a ship-sized repulsor lift coming in from kilometers away, Mara said.
Jumping down off the side of the ramp, she dropped to one knee beside one of the dead Garrels and dug her free hand into the fur at its neck.
Which means that if they've been radio-tagged, the controllers in Mount Tentus know we're here.
Great, Han muttered, crouching down beside the dead Garrel at his feet.
What do we look for? A collar?
Probably, Mara said. Check around the legs, too.
It took a few anxious minutes, but in the end they confirmed that none of the dead predators had been tagged.
Must be descendants of the group they brought in to protect the mountain, Lando said.
Or else this is where they came from originally, Mara said. I never saw their home planet listed.
It's trouble either way, Han said, shoving the last carcass off the Falcon's ramp to crunch into the leaf cover below. If we can't use the speeder bikes, it means we're walking. From up above came a low electronic whistle.
Pardon me, sir, 3PO asked. Does that also apply to R2 and me?
Unless you've learned how to fly, Han said.
Well, sir, it occurs to me that R2 in particular isn't really equipped for this sort of forest travel,
3PO pointed out primly.
If the cargo plat can't be used, perhaps other arrangements can be made.
The arrangement is that you walk like the rest of us, Han said shortly.
Getting into a long discussion with 3PO wasn't how he'd been planning to spend his day.
You did it on Endor, you can do it here.
We didn't have nearly as far to go on Endor, Luke reminded him quietly. We must be about 2 weeks' walk from the mountain here.
It's not that bad, Han said, doing a quick estimate. It wasn't that bad, but it was bad enough. 8 or 9 days, tops. Maybe a couple more if we run into trouble.
Oh, we'll run into trouble, all right,
Mara said sourly, sitting down on the ramp and dropping her blaster into her lap.
Trust me on that one.
You don't expect the natives to be hospitable? Lando asked.
I expect them to welcome us with open crossbows, Mara retorted.
This book is continued on cassette number 8, side 1.